Organizers of this symposium asked me to talk about forage legumes, whether the nutritive value of the forage quality is more important or the nitrogen fixation, and how it might vary from one region to another. So I'll see what I can do with this. I also have some contributors. I called quite a few people from around the U.S., so I would like to share the glory or the shame, however it comes out. Legumes have always been considered the highest quality forage that we can grow or produce. This is some work with some co-workers a long time ago, Hagen Lipke, Marvin Rewe, but it's been used in other textbooks and publications and so forth. But the legume has always, as a range, always had the highest nutritive value or forage quality. Now, the forage quality of legumes basically are primarily determined by the legume species and the maturity, as one would expect. If we look at two distinct species like white clover and alfalfa, white clover is stoloniferous, primarily used for grazing. It's recognized the world around, I think, as the highest quality legume we've got. But it's stoloniferous, and so the animals are primarily grazing leaves and petioles. And so they're not grazing stems, which have a lower nutritive value than the leaves do. On the other hand, alfalfa is primarily harvested for hay or silage, probably over 95% of it. And so the stage at which it is harvested has a lot of influence over the nutritive value. This is some work by Bob Barnes published in the Agronomy Monogram on alfalfa, but basically as your yield increases with maturity, your percent crude protein goes down and percent DDM goes down. Same thing is true for the Coosies and Angels. This is some work by Brink and Fairbrother in North Mississippi using subterranean clover and Bersim clover. But if you look at the yellow line, that's Bersim yield. These samples were taken every 10 days during the springtime, but it increases with time, and then the last sampling went down a little bit. Subterranean clover is an annual clover, but it is also stoloniferous, and it's the black line, so it reaches a certain height, and then the yield decreases. But its yield generally goes up. The two top lines, the light purple and the blue line, the percent digestible dry matter decreases, and if you look at the green and red line at the bottom, that's the percent protein. So the same thing is true for annuals as perennials. I'm going to turn to nitrogen fixation now. And most people know about it, but few people really understand it. So I'm going to deviate from my charge a little bit. When you get to be retirement age, you can do things like that. But I'm going to spend some time on talking about nitrogen fixation and why there's so much variability across the U.S. and among species. Relatively speaking, there's a lot of information on forage quality. But there's very little information on nitrogen fixation by legumes in comparison. Nitrogen fixation is more variable because there's a big interaction between your legume species, rhizobia strain, soil type, soil nutrient level, and of course climate. Just to put us all on the same page, it's just the nitrogen fixation process. The rhizobia bacteria remove nitrogen from the air, change it to ammonium, the form a plant can use. The legume plant carries on photosynthesis, builds the sugars, the energy level for the rhizobia bacteria. The only reason I show this is that the legume plant is a major component of this thing. Anything that happens to that legume plant is going to affect the amount of nitrogen fixation. One of the things that affects your legume growth is the length of growing season. If you compare a cool-season annual like crimson clover, Bersim clover, arrowleaf clover, we plant them in the fall in the lower south, but they produce about 85 to 90% of their growth in the spring, March, April, and May. And so we have a relatively short period of growing where we're producing a lot of forage and a lot of nitrogen. Contrast that to alfalfa that you might get have a 6 to 8 month growing season depending on the latitude. There's a big difference. The more forage you produce, the more potential nitrogen you can get fixed. Legume adaptability, if you take a legume that's not It may be well adapted to one soil. It may fix 150, 200 pounds of nitrogen. You put it on a soil that it's not well adapted, less growth, less nitrogen fixation. Of course, your soil fertility and pH are greatly going to affect your legume growth. Make sure you need to have all the nutrients there, and a pH will affect that. And, of course, the climatic factors, moisture, temperature, and light. And the main thing about light is it a pure standard legume like alfalfa, or is it a mixture of a legume and a grass? If you got a grass in that mixture, there's going to be competition for sunlight, so there'll be less nitrogen fixation from that standpoint. And then, of course, defoliation. Are you going to come in there and completely cut it off like you would harvesting alfalfa for for hay or for silage, or is it going to be grazed? So all those factors come into play. A few things about the rhizobia strain. Number one is there a commercially available rhizobia strain that really has the potential to fix a lot of nitrogen? We have actually taken a step backwards in getting the right strain for the right legume species. 15, 20 years ago, if you planted white clover, red clover, there was a strain for it. There was one for alfalfa and sweet clover. There was one for arrowleaf clover. There was one that worked on crimson and one of the other clovers, or a strain that worked for subclover. Anyway, we were trying to match up the clover species with the most effective rhizobia strain. With the consolidation of the inoculant business, we have fewer companies now and they're bigger. Clover inoculants are just a small picture of their pie. The big inoculants are soybeans and the pulse crops up in Canada, then alfalfa, and then probably the perennial clovers like white and red clover, and annual clovers are on the bottom. So we're really going backwards in that sense. Inoculant quality, and that's basically the number of rhizobia per gram of inoculant. We do not have any standards in the U.S. on inoculant equality. Fortunately, most of these companies also sell inoculant in Canada, and they do have standards. So that helps us in that respect. Adaptability and survival of introduced strains. When we select strains for a particular legume species, it's done in the greenhouse. We sterilize our potting material. We sterilize everything. So we make sure that the strain we put on that particular treatment is the one that has the potential to infect that clover species or legume species. Well, what happens in the real world? You put that inoculant on that clover seed or legume seed, and you plant it, and you also have competition from other organisms, other soil microorganisms. So it may have done great in the greenhouse where you sterilize everything else and there's no competition or interference from other microorganisms, but you put it in the soil and it's a completely different world. We talk about adaptability. Again, in the greenhouse, it's sterile. We're using a potting material, probably sand or vermiculite. But how will that rhizobia species or a strain perform in the soil? Would it work better as well in a pH of 6 as in a pH of 7 or a pH of 7.5? There's no way of knowing unless you really go out and check those things. So we have a big discrepancy on how these strains are affected in the greenhouse and how they actually perform out in the field. There are some terms that we use, ineffectiveness and effectiveness. Ineffectiveness relates to how well a particular strain infects a legume species. How many infection sites does it tie up or get into? Effectiveness is how effective is that strain at fixing nitrogen out of the air. And just because it has good ineffectiveness does not mean it's going to be very effective at fixing nitrogen and vice versa. Two different things. And then there's the competition from indigenous strains. The soil, most soils are filled with different native or indigenous rhizobia strains. So this strain that's sold on the market, that was selected under greenhouse conditions, you put it out in the soil, and all of a sudden it has to compete with these native rhizobia or indigenous rhizobia strains, and which ones are going to infect the legume that you plant. And it's pretty much a numbers game. The rhizobia strain and the largest population is the one that's going to tie up most of the infection sites. And a good example that I had was that I went into an area and I was going to plant subterranean clover in it. And it had quite a bit of annual medic growing in this particular area before. But I disked it up, planted subterranean clover. Annual medic came up bright green. Subterranean clover was a pale green and died. The rhizobia strain that works on annual medics tied up all the infection sites on the subclover. So you have a competition problem. The other thing is the legume species can be infected by more than one rhizobia strain. So you got one strain infecting it, two or three, or a half a dozen. You just don't know. This was a study that we did at Overton in cooperation with Carolyn Young and Rushi Sinjai from the Noble Foundation. We're working on releasing a ball clover variety. And the recommendation is that you use the white clover inoculant on the ball clover. And what we did, I went to a site near Kilgore, which on a ranch that had been growing ball clover on this site for 4 or 5 years, and it did really well. And so we sampled the seedlings, and we sampled some seedlings, ball clover seedlings at our Overton site, and we sent them up to the Noble Foundation, and they sampled some white clover seedlings, and they plated out all the different rhizobia strains. And we didn't test all of them, but we've got one, two, three, we've got four, five strains from Kilgore. Same ball clover plant, but they isolated five different strains. But we tested this in the greenhouse, and we sampled at 35 days, 49 days, and at 63. And this is the seedling weight of the ball clover seedlings. Let's see if I can get this to work. But the control is this line right here. The white clover was also down here, so it wasn't much better than the control. The solid line is the Overton 7 strain, and this dashed line is the Kilgore strain. So there's a lot of difference in how much nitrogen that these different strains fix. So it's a very complicated process. Of course, the environment makes a difference. Soil pH can be too high or can be too low for the rhizobia strain, for rhizobia survival. High-low temperatures can reduce nitrogen fixation, and soil nitrogen levels can reduce nitrogen fixation. Legumes are basically lazy. If they have a source of soil nitrogen, they'll take it out of the soil before they'll carry on nitrogen fixation and remove the nitrogen from the air. And soil type makes a difference. It's been my experience in doing a lot of variety testing on different soils in the eastern half of Texas that if you get a soil site where a particular legume species is very well adapted, you show no response to inoculation. So you begin to wonder, there's obviously a native strain of rhizobia that's doing a very good job. So when we say this legume isn't adapted to that soil, is it the legume or is it the rhizobia strain that's not well adapted to that soil? And of course, we need all the nutrients for nitrogen fixation. Nitrogen transfer pathways, once you get it in the legume, taking it to the soil. The two biggies are recycling through livestock. The other one is degradation of legume plant material. And there's three other minor ways of getting that nitrogen transferred. Okay, get back on track here for a minute. I divided the U.S. up into four major areas. Hope I don't start another civil war when I separated the Midwest from the South, but anyway. And then I also subdivided the Southeast into two regions. But we'll go through each region. If you look at the northeastern U.S., alfalfa and perennial clovers support the dairy industry. And that's the main industry in the Northeast. Forage legumes are planted for the high quality. The reason being is that a dairy producer can tell the difference in the milk tank the next day when he has a difference in forage quality in that diet. Alfalfa is primarily harvested for hay, or it can be harvested for silage. Your perennial clovers, like white clover and red clover, are primarily grown in mixtures with your temperate perennial grasses. Moving to the Midwest, As far as the legumes are growing, of course, alfalfa is growing in a corn rotation on your better soils, your level of rolling land. On your more hilly land, corn's rotated with alfalfa, or it might be a perennial grass clover pasture. And half the alfalfa is usually harvested for hay and half for silage. The perennial clovers, again, white and red clover, some kuya clover, they're primarily grown in mixtures with temperate perennial grasses and used for grazing. Getting back to the alfalfa usage in the Midwest, the alfalfa acreage is actually decreasing, mainly because the new varieties have not produced any increase in alfalfa yield, or very little. On the other hand, growing corn for corn silage, on the average, there's been a 2-3% increase in corn yield over the last 10 or 15 years. So they've made more progress with corn than they have with alfalfa. The other advantage is corn following alfalfa, you get a 10-20% more higher corn yield. And there are approximately 4 million acres of alfalfa in the Midwest. Dan Undersander shared this with me. I went ahead and put his name on here since I copied his slide. But these are the benefits that Dan has seen in the Midwest. Of course, it provides nitrogen for the following crop, breaks the disease insect cycles, improves soil condition, reduces erosion of your cropping system, reduces weeds of the following crop, increases yield, and of course, it gives a greater economic return when you increase yield. We move over to the western U.S., and now we're primarily looking at dairies that are large confinement dairies. And they primarily use the irrigated alfalfa and the corn silage. Also in the west, we've got extensive beef cattle and sheep operations, and the legumes there are primarily used in irrigated and dryland hay meadows, primarily for hay. Alfalfa is a major legume and it's usually irrigated, but there's a little bit of dry land. The hay is harvested for the dairy industry primarily. Some beef, horse industry probably uses about 10% of the alfalfa hay in the West. Some is exported when it's a profitable deal. And in a few cases, particularly in Montana and Idaho, it's grazed as a standing hay crop in the fall after they've taken a hay cutting. Some of your minor legumes, sainfoin, white clover, birdfoot trefoil, and sweet clover. Again, just talking a little more about the alfalfa. The dairy industry pretty well drives the alfalfa acreage. If you look where the dairy industry is, you don't know whether the dairy industry is following alfalfa or alfalfa is following the dairy industry. I suspect the dairy industry is following the alfalfa because areas that you can grow alfalfa very well, dry land or irrigated, that appears to be where you have your highest concentration of dairy cattle. About 40% of the U.S. milk production is in the western U.S. at this time. With the low milk prices, maybe that'll shift a little bit back towards the Midwest. And like I said, about 90-98% of the alfalfa acreage is irrigated because of the low rainfall in the western half of the United States. Also in the western U.S., the alfalfa is rotated with wheat, corn, tomatoes, and with the specialty crops like vegetables. And the reason being is alfalfa is pretty consistent, good high yielder. They don't make a lot of money, but it's a consistent moneymaker for them. And so they rotate that with other crops and like vegetables, because vegetables, crops like lettuce, things like that, is a boom or bust thing. Sometimes the weather's not right, they don't make a crop, or they get a disease problem, or they just have an average crop. But that 1 year out of five when they just really go gangbusters and everything works right. And so alfalfa is more of a, kind of keeps things on an even keel form, steady income. Other forage legumes which I've already covered, the white clover, red clover, birdfoot trefoil, and sainfoin, they are used in grass mixtures. Some of the annual clovers that are used are bursim, subterranean clover, rose clover, and hairy vetch. And they're primarily used as cover crops in orchards and vineyards, which account for about 360,000 hectares in the western part of the U.S. And they're also rotated with vegetables. Okay, now we'll go back to the southeast. And I divided the southeast with this dash line right here, and it pretty well follows this temperature zone on the U.S. winter cold hardiness map here. And I did that for a reason. In the southeast, primary agricultural livestock enterprises are small beef cattle operations. Producers plant legumes primarily because the nitrogen is a bigger issue than the nutritive value. Because we have very infertile soils in the southeast primarily. It's usually sandy, low fertility. So they're real concerned about having to add nitrogen fertilizer. So they say they plant legumes for the nitrogen instead of the nutritive value. And beef cattle do not have as high nutrient requirements as the dairy cattle do. Annual clovers are primarily grown south of I-20 or the lower south, below that dashed line that I put in there. And the reason being is that we have trouble with perennial legumes persisting during the summer. We would love to have a cool season or a warm season perennial that would stay with us year in and year out, but usually they lack persistence. And so we're stuck with having to grow annuals. Primarily, the annual clovers are overseeded on warm season perennial grasses in the fall, usually Bermuda grass, Bahia grass, and they may be sown in pure stands or with ryegrass. You get north of that line, north of I-20, and white clover becomes the predominant forage legume because it's cooler temperatures and it will persist better. The primary use for the white clover is to put it in tall fescue that's infected with a toxic endophyte. There's also some annual perennial Lespedeza growing in the southeast. I put this back up there, and I put in different nutrient requirements for classes of livestock, but in the lower south, I didn't mean to do that. In the lower south, we're stuck with warm season perennial grasses, Bermuda grass, Bahia grass, blue stems, Dallas grass, things like that. And they have the lowest nutritive value of any forage class. So the fact that the producers plant the clovers or any cool season legume for nitrogen, the forage quality probably improves their animal performance more than anything. But they just don't recognize it all the time. Milk producer, he can look in the milk tank the next day or two and see a difference. If a beef cattle producer has higher weaning rates, higher conception rate, he changed breed of bull, he used different management, he fed a different mineral, the clover or the legume just doesn't ever seem to get the credit for it. But it happens. There were some studies done, quite a few grazing studies done in Alabama. Out of 37 grazing studies with stocker calves, they used both cool and warm season perennial grasses and legumes. And Don Ball compiled these, and they figured the cost of gain with 2008 prices. And the studies were ranked according to pasture costs per pound of animal gain. And seven of the top seven, or that had the lowest cost of gain, all had a legume component. And nine out of the best 10 had a legume component. So even though the beef cattle producers are planting them for the nitrogen, there's a great benefit from the forage quality. Again, the cool season annual legumes are overseeded on warm season perennial grasses. And although we plant them in the fall, 80 to 90% of that forage production occurs in the spring over about a three-month period. So they're not perennials. We'd like to have a perennial, but we're going to have to live with annuals until we can get a perennial that does work for us. But the other advantage to this is, in this scenario, the legume growth precedes the grass growth, the summer grass. And the two main methods of nitrogen transfer from the legume to the grass is grazing with livestock and the decay of any legume plant material. So we get excellent nitrogen transfer from the legume plant to the summer grass because we can graze these Mix it with ryegrass, we can graze it. Plus, the legume dies May, or its arrowleaf clover, it might be June, and any decay of any plant material will benefit the nitrogen transfer. In summary, in reality, the reason livestock producers plant forage legumes is irrelevant. They get both benefits. They get the forage quality, and they get the nitrogen fixation. Dairy producers use forage legumes for the high quality because they have a high, the dairy cattle have a high nutrient requirement. Beef producers put a greater emphasis on nitrogen fixation because the beef cattle have a lower nutrient requirement, but in essence, they get a great benefit out of the nitrogen, out of the higher quality. And also, forage legumes have a major role in crop rotations and as winter cover crops. Thank you very much.